Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Impact Factor. I am your host, Katie Van Aken, and this week my guest is a professor who did his postdoc in the same lab that I did my PhD. And his story and path is really interesting, and I'm excited for you to hear it. So without further ado, here is Professor Chris Schuck. Chris, well, I actually don't know if I know some of this, but can you start by telling me about your undergrad, specifically what you studied, but also what your research experience was like in undergrad?
Sure. So I went to Princeton for my undergrad, and I joined the chemical engineering department there. While I was at Princeton, so Princeton doesn't have minors. We have certificates, which are minors. So I got a certificate in material science and a certificate in engineering biology because I didn't know which I really wanted to do. And so my first research experience was in a using NMR for research, actually. So it was in the chemistry department. That only lasted, it was a special program that I think was funded by NSF, looking back on it. Then afterwards, I emailed a bunch of random professors in chemistry and chemical engineering that did biology research. And I ended up working with a professor who was doing structural protein work in terms of how do you understand how proteins can be modulated by different amino acids. Very cool stuff. I ended up going to the Czech Republic to work with her collaborators there. Unfortunately, I didn't get any papers or anything out of that. And then I realized when I was doing all that research that biology was too complicated for me. I just couldn't handle it. So I decided to do, at Princeton, you have to do a senior thesis. So it's like a full-year research project. So I ended up doing my senior thesis on desorption kinetics of alkali metals from transition metal surfaces. Mm. And so this was actually at a Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory.
Cool. But was that still within your department? Because your department was biological, but also chemical
stuff? Yeah, so actually the professor I worked with first, so the NMR professor was in chemistry. The protein professor was also chemistry. And then my senior thesis was in chemical engineering.
Okay. Interesting. Did you immediately like that field of study more?
Materials or?
Just which? Moving away from like proteins and biology.
Yeah, well, I realized because I was trying to look at thermodynamics of proteins that you only have a certain number of elements in proteins, but they're so incredibly complicated that I just couldn't wrap my head around how all of this stuff was happening with proteins. And if you look at something like, you know, desorption of one thing from another, or you know, any kind of simple materials reaction or simple chemical reaction, it's orders of magnitude less complicated in terms of just like total amount of stuff that's happening around. Yeah. And for me, I had trouble dealing with the complexity of proteins and, you know, 8 million things happening that you just don't understand. And so for me, it was moving to the more simple systems, even with, you know, complicated transition metals or complicated chemistries of individual atoms, ended up being a lot more simple because I could wrap my head around everything in quotes.
That system. Yeah. Everything. Yeah. That's interesting. It's an interesting way to look back on that. I find that cool. So you're doing research. You have to do research as part of your thesis. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like at that point in your life you kind of caught the research bug, or what made you decide to continue on in your research studies?
I mean, generally, what surprised me is when I moved into that lab for my senior thesis, was how simple the system was, and yet how little was known about it. To put it in context, right? My research was essentially on making a plasma-facing material and how it deals with hydrogen, which is, you know, plasma. And
so you have two variables there. You have hydrogen and you have the material.
Right. And
yeah.
And so what would happen is if you heat up the lithium, so the alkali metal, from whatever transition metal is actually the backing of it, you're in vacuum and you're exposing it to plasma, and it would actually desorb from the surface and cause problems. And so it ended up being, you know, very interesting because it's the people I was working with there. It's like a DOE funded lab. It's incredibly intelligent people, like very diligent, very, very hardworking, very complicated systems. And something that was seemingly as simple as that just wasn't known yet. It still wasn't known. And people have been doing plasma materials and fusion for, I don't know how many years, 60, 65, 70 years at that point.
Enough.
Yeah,
enough
many, years. Many years.
Yeah.
So it's what like really amazed me is you could have these simple systems that are incredibly applicable to the future of energy, at there's just gaps in knowledge at gaps in knowledge that are incredibly relevant for actual use of these technologies.
Yeah. That's cool. So did you end up pursuing something similar for your PhD?
What it is in terms of similar was once I realized that there was a system that was this simple that just wasn't known, I was like, kind of, I got the idea that I wanted to do my PhD on something that seems, that seems simple on the surface, but is actually a lot more complicated than meets the eye. And
like
so
when you start digging into it.
Yeah. So what it was is my PI, so I did my PhD at University of Notre Dame. My PI was doing solid state combustion reactions. And that sounds really weird.
It does.
It's really weird because it's these reactions are exothermic enough that you initiate, if you like cold press a pellet out of it and you initiate the reaction from the top, the exothermicity of the reaction will cause the entire reaction to occur in a self-sustaining combustion front. And so as an aside,
because of the shape of the...
Just because of the exothermicity of your reaction. So the system I was working with was nickel and aluminum. And if you react two of those together just in their elemental form, it will go up to 1600 Celsius by itself without oxygen, without anything. And so some of these reactions actually go up to almost 4000 Celsius.
Wow.
And in many of these cases, there's no melting, there's no gas phase. So it's all solid state. And so if you think about that, so that reaction itself is quite literally A plus B goes to C. Yeah. Nickel plus aluminum to nickel aluminide, NiAl, right?
Yep.
Literally A plus B goes to C.
Very simple for you.
Very simple. Yeah. But whenever I first joined the lab, the question was, what is the activation and energy of this reaction, right? Mm-hmm. And so on the surface level, you're like, that has to be known. There's no way that's not known. There's no way. But whenever I started digging through literature, people were reporting activation energies from 15 to 400 kilojoules per mole. And I was like, how on earth? How on earth is this being reported like this, right?
Yeah.
It was like, that's not even like within uncertainty. That's just like completely
uncertain.
Completely different orders of magnitude. And so what it took me, what I ended up realizing that was happening is people were treating this simple system as simpler than it actually was. Because there's a couple ways you could approach this, right? If you have just nickel powder and aluminum powder, they both have an oxide shell. So you don't actually have them touching each other.
True.
So you have to have some kind of melting, cracking of the oxide shell, and then reaction. Even if you get rid of that oxide shell, so if you do mechanical activation or another treatment, and you have the direct contact of nickel to aluminum, you still have to deal with diffusion. And so we're not in the gas phase. Diffusion's not quick. And so if you think about what's actually happening, right, you have a contribution from diffusion and then a contribution from a reaction. And so by changing your surface area to volume ratio, you're changing the amount of grain boundary diffusion, surface diffusion, and volume diffusion. And then you have your fourth activation energy, which is your actual reaction activation energy. And so, depending on what your surface area to volume ratio is, you can actually change the activation energy of this reaction between 400 and like 15. It blew my mind because that wasn't known. People were just reporting it. They're like, we ball milled it, we pressed it. This is the activation energy.
This is what we measured.
Yep, they're like, this is what we measured. And they weren't wrong. And that's the thing. That's the coolest thing. They weren't wrong. It was everyone was right. Everyone was right in this. It's just no one was looking at like the bigger picture. It was people were treating it like it was a gas phase reaction, but without understanding the complexity of it.
Very cool. So it's interesting because it is material science, but it's almost like it's like surface interaction or like systems material science, you know?
Yeah, so this is actually what's funny about my background. I have no degrees in material science.
Nice.
In many cases, it's both of my degrees are in chemical engineering from both Princeton, from Notre Dame, and ostensibly I've worked on material science in
Everywhere.
everywhere. Yeah, but it's from more of a chemical engineering or kinetics based approach. Which is different from the kinetics we normally think of as material science kinetics. Because to be honest, most material scientists don't like to go into PDEs,
No.
so.
I hate thermodynamics, all that stuff. So looking back on, or when you were looking for a PhD program, were you looking for specific research topics or schools with good programs? What was kind of your driving force?
So what I was doing is, I had a number of schools that I was interested in. It was a very large list. It was like 50 or 60 schools, places that I thought I would enjoy, like, Notre Dame, places kind of honestly all over the country. And then what I did from there is I wanted a degree in chemical engineering. So I looked at the chemical engineering departments in each of those schools. And I was like, if there's two people I would like to work with, two or three people, then I'll apply to the school. If there's not, I'm not gonna apply. And I didn't really take prestige or anything of that into the calculus of it, because for your PhD, you're gonna be working for 4 to 7 years. If I'm working for 4 to 7 years, I don't care if it's at, the greatest school in the world by name or the worst school in the name by name. If you're not going to enjoy what you're doing, you're going to hate your time there. And
Yeah, it's a
so,
long time to hate what
yeah,
you're doing.
right. And so for me, the name of the school didn't matter. It was more so the kind of research being done, and then especially the personality of the PI. Because, I mean, honestly, like, even if you're doing something that you're like 75% interested in, but you and your PI are like, you click, then it's wonderful. But if you're like 100% into some kind of research, but you're butting heads of your PI all the time, like, you're gonna have a miserable time.
So true. So when you ended up at Notre Dame, was that a type of program where you get admitted into a group or do you do rotations?
So Notre Dame doesn't do rotations even. So you're not admitted into a group. You literally just choose. Yeah.
Like day one.
Basically, you meet with a PI, you can meet their people, but there's no rotation.
Okay.
And so it's, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a bad method. It's just how they do it. And so you end up spending, it's the onus is a lot more on the individual grad students to seek out, people in the lab, to talk with a PI, to talk with others, and kind of get the gist of what that person's about and what their reputation is. And I mean, you could even do that on your visit day as well. So if you when you visit, if you're specifically interested in working with PI X, you go and talk to that person, you make sure you vibe with them.
What did, where did the funding come from? Did, was there like different groups that had different spots
I'm sorry.
available? Was there
In
like,
terms of just the PI I was working with?
or just in general as like a first, like a class of new grad students, were there like different spots available for different professors who had funding?
Yeah, so not every single professor was hiring people.
Okay, gotcha.
Notre Dame's chemical engineering department of a PhD cohort is actually fairly small relative to most PhD departments. And it's because the chemical engineering doesn't do TAs. So you have to TA for like a 1 or 2 years, but it's not like in chemistry where you can be supported on a TA ship.
For your whole time.
Yeah, so the PI has to have funding for you. And so
Gotcha.
usually, generally, PIs there hire 1 to 2 people per year. Or I would actually say 0 to 2 people per year. So
Okay.
it's not that every PI hires someone every year, but it depends on how much funding they have and how many people they want.
How big was your group?
We were about 15 people. There's about 15 of us, but then 2 years later, there was a year of five. So
I
I
see.
think yeah, I think Notre Dame tried to aim for around 15.
And missed.
Yeah, I mean, 1 year they missed. So the next year they hired more people. But so it's kind of easy to fix it, I guess.
And your research group was how big?
3 people.
Okay.
So that's including the PI.
Oh, okay.
So when I joined, I joined a lab that the previous grad student had just graduated, and he was staying on as a postdoc for like 3 or 4 months, purely to train me.
To train you,
Yeah. And so basically for the first 3 months of my PhD, during classes, during all of this, I would go to classes and then we would meet up, and from about 4 p.m. till 10 or 11, he would train me on different stuff in lab. And then whenever my first semester ended, he left. And so it
Here's what
was,
you know. Goodbye.
yeah, he was like, I mean, he was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. He was very, very patient, but he was just like, we got to do this. I know it sucks. He was like, we only have like 3 months together, and it's in the middle of your classes because I have a job and I have to leave.
Yeah. Did he did you basically carry on his work, or was it just general lab training, like
Was just general
techniques?
lab training. It's his, so his project ended because his funding ended.
Okay.
And so when I joined, my professor, my PI, had won this larger, he was a member of this larger DOE grant, one of the PSAP2 programs, so the predictive science programs. And so this program was 3 different schools, actually. So we were Notre Dame, Indiana University, and Purdue University. And
Oh,
this
cool.
was an experimental, computational, and then like computer science program that was meant to do predictive modeling. And so the postdoc, basically, during the first 3 months, we basically worked on figuring out the basics of what I had to do in that project. And he trained me on that kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
Because his project was completely different, honestly.
That's a nice resource to have, because like, when are you ever going to get that much time with like the PI, for example?
Right. Well, I mean, that's honestly the thing that was amazing about that lab. My PI, 100% amazing guy. He was not a micromanager. He was incredibly, so he was like this, to give you, I'll just give you a little background on him. He'd come from a USSR in the 90s, and he had that way of approaching science that only like someone from USSR could, where they would blatantly say you're wrong, but they weren't being mean. He was just like, that's wrong because of XYZ. And he did not pull any punches in this way. He was like, you know, if you're saying it's like this, go through the physics, do the derivation, and show me that it's like that. And if he was wrong, he was like, okay, that's what it is. Like, great. And so for him, you know, I would meet with him, you know, once or twice a week, just kind of whenever I wanted to, just to kind of pitch ideas, talk about stuff, and plan stuff out. And having that much one-on-one with a PI, and it's he wasn't, he was like, when I started, how old was he? In his early to mid-50s, I'll say. So he was like well known internationally in his field. He was incredibly smart. He knew the history of everything that was going on in the field. He knew a million different techniques, literally everyone in the world who did this kind of stuff. And so he was like a walking encyclopedia for anything you could want to know, and you were willing to ask and willing to go through the derivations with him.
What a resource.
Yeah, he was absolutely wonderful, amazing guy.
Very cool. So did he, what made you, spoiler, you're a professor now, but we'll get to that. But at what point did you know you wanted to pursue that academic route?
Honestly, from working with him, because you know, I had it in my mind I wanted to be a professor when I went to grad school, and then whenever you're in grad school, you kind of float back and forth. You're like, I hate, you know, I hate what I'm doing. I never want to do this. And you're like, I love what I'm doing when stuff starts working. And the thing that really got like made me really, really want to be a professor and continue pursuing is the way he mentored me. It's he genuinely wanted to make sure I understood and made impacts in the field. He would take me to conferences that I have no idea how he afforded them. Honestly, I have no idea how he afforded these conferences. It would be like my first conference was in Turkey. Yeah, I was like, and like, spoiler, now that I'm writing grants, I'm like, how did he afford this? I'm like, how on earth did he afford this? But that's like the kind of person he was. He was like, I want to take you to this conference because it's the best conference in our field. And he's like, come hell or high water, I'll figure out a way to get you there.
Because it's a good
And
experience for you, and he knows
right. He
that.
was like, it's a great experience. You get to meet people in the field. You're never going to meet most of these people otherwise. And he's like, you know, you when we were there, he's introducing me to people. He's like, this person discovered this topic in the 1980s in Kazakhstan that was showing blah blah blah, and he could explain this and all of this kind of stuff. I met so many different people, and it's the way he approached it is he there was honestly no benefit for him introducing 22, 23-year-old me to, you know, some guy he knew from 40 years ago. But he did it because he wanted me to know these people and learn from them and, you know, go to their talks and read their papers and understand their approach to science, not just his.
Yeah, that's a good mentor right there.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you know you want to be a professor. You finish with your PhD. I assume you knew that the next step for you was a postdoc.
Yeah.
And is that when you ended up at Drexel?
That is.
Okay. So my first question for you, because I know about the group that you ended up at, is what was it like going from a three-person group to a million-person group?
Yeah. So I assume you've talked to other people from Yuri's group on this podcast.
Yeah, a couple. Yeah, but you can t just, yeah,
Yeah.
you can
So
just share.
just a quick aside to so like I said, I went from a three-person group where I knew how to do XRD, SEM, TEM, TGA, XPS, everything, to a group of 40 to 50 people where you have people doing incredible specialization on specific, super specific topics in this really big lab. And so It was difficult, honestly, because one of the difficulties that I faced in joining this larger lab is there was really no kind of guardrails on anything when I first joined. So, especially for postdocs. So when I joined, I got onboarded in one day. I talked with Yuri, and then they kind of were like, he was like, yeah, go to lab and figure out what your project is. And it's kind of like, I was going from fundamental materials kinetics, I'll say, to, synthesizing two-dimensional materials for a million applications. And it was difficult because it's very easy to fall through the cracks in a situation like this. Where you go, there's honestly no one checking on you. Nobody's going to take responsibility. Nobody's your mentor. There's no, person coming to say, we want to teach you these techniques and show you how to do this stuff. You instead have to kind of ask around, figure out who is doing what, figure out who actually knows what they're doing whenever everyone has their own way of doing stuff. And then you have to figure out what's the best way of doing it, and then a project. And it's not a bad approach to running a lab. It's if you're a PI of a 30, 40, 50 person group, Yuri can't have oversight on every single person. There's absolutely no way. And this approach lets, especially postdocs, when you come in, he's not giving you a preconceived notion to say, this is a problem I want you to figure out. He's saying, you're a smart person. You figure out one of these problems and then basically try to show that it's a problem and work on it. And so it's just a different approach to doing science. It was a hard transition. Not because I was, lost in the science or anything, but it's learning some of the specific techniques, because at the time when I joined, which was in 2018, there was a lot of Max and Maxine synthesis stuff that just wasn't known. That, like, in the rumor mill, someone knew something about it, and you had to track them down and figure out what it was. But then people were worried about getting scooped, so they weren't willing to tell people stuff. And it was, I mean, it's different. I guess it's different being in one of these more high profile, fields of science where there's, a million papers getting published all the
It's a
time.
race.
Yeah, it's a race. So, like, I don't blame anyone. It's if someone shows me the latest and greatest way of doing something, but it's not published yet, it just met me. It's like, how do they know I'm not gonna scoop them? And like, I totally get that.
But it kind of forces you to be autonomous and build those relationships within your own lab, which is interesting and also kind of maybe useful skill-wise for then when you're a professor, because you have to do that.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, it's useful. I would say both of those experiences, and for anyone listening, I recommend don't just, join two labs for your PhD and postdoc that's three people
Kind of
and
the
three
same.
people. Yeah, like, yeah. I tell every single person this. I'm like, you get completely different experiences being in a large lab and a small lab, or even a medium versus small or medium versus large, and you get different skills. You get different expertise. Like I said, I worked on SEM, TEM, XRD, every characterization during my PhD. And then as a postdoc, I only did SEM and XRD, but I focused way, way more on XRD and understood it on a much more deep level than, any of the other techniques I knew during my PhD.
And you also had a chance to mentor a handful of grad students, right? Was that a good experience?
Yeah, so I've worked with a ton of graduate students. I've worked with a ton of undergraduate students. I think by my count, I had seven or eight undergraduates work directly with me, and then I had maybe 15 senior design undergraduate students. And
Nice.
then a handful of PhD students who I worked with them very extensively to get their PhD projects up and running. To make sure they hit their milestones, got papers, and didn't get bogged down in the, endless void of things that could happen. I was going to say that's actually one kind of problem that I see with some of these larger labs is, you have new PhD students who come in and they get overwhelmed because there's a million things you can do. Like, everyone joining a PhD program is a pretty smart person, right? You're smart, you're hardworking. And you see, if you join a lab that's like 40 people, you see 40 different projects. And in your mind, you're like, I can make a contribution to every one of these projects, or even half or a quarter of these projects. That's still like 10 projects. And then it's very easy to get
And you need
lost.
something that's yours.
Right.
You
It's
need
easy to
something
get
that's
pulled in all of these
yours.
directions and not have anything of your own. And that's one of the things I was really good at. Just I would notice PhD students doing this, and I would just be like, let's just sit down and you tell me what your PhD thesis is or what you want it to be, and we'll figure out how you get to that.
Early on,
Yeah,
right? Like
it's like
let's define it early on.
right. It's like you would finish your classes, spend 2 or 3 months doing stuff in lab, and I'm like, okay, what are you interested in? And if they're interested in literally any topic, we could plan out how a PhD goes in that direction. But if you're just like, I don't know, I have no idea what my PhD is, then in a huge lab like this, you just get lost.
Yeah, so true. Well, I feel like that skill set will carry forth towards your professorship.
I
You'll
hope
be able
so.
to help your own grad students, right?
Right? I mean, that's the goal, right? It's that's actually one of the things. So I'm going through I get my first two rotation students. So Rutgers does rotations, which my lab's not set up. So I have two students and I have to set up my lab right now. So it's kind of
Like you don't have anything to experiment on.
right. So I'm like,
So, yeah.
I
Are they helping you set up the lab?
Well, yeah, I just got my first couple of pieces of equipment.
Cool.
I got my first couple of pieces of equipment, but I don't have any tools to actually take the boxes apart.
Oh,
So I
nice.
have to order tools now. But yeah, it's with a PhD student. So I'm like, look, here's like five or six big research directions we can go in. Each of these has like a roughly a million different subdirections we could go in as well. I'm like, I want you to like, here's one paper that describes each one of these broad directions. And I'm like, you tell me your top two. Whatever your top two are. Because right now I don't have to do reporting for grants because I don't have any grants
Have
yet.
any
I don't
grants?
have any grants. So I'm like, we could literally do anything.
Could
And
do
then this
whatever.
will form the basis of these grants that I'm gonna write.
Right.
And so for the students doing rotation, I'm like, just read a couple of these papers. Whichever of these directions you're most interested in, we'll do some experiments. We'll mess around, do some stuff for first 6 weeks of a rotation. If you like doing it, then you can join my lab permanently. If you're like, man, I hate doing this stuff, then it's not for you.
I mean that's great. I would love. I feel like a lot of PhD students would like the opportunity to just be like, what can I do that I like,
Right.
you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's as a PhD student, this is the first opportunity you generally get to do that, right? You could be the world's greatest undergraduate researcher, but I don't think that many PIs are going to be like, go wild,
Probably not.
go wild, do whatever you want.
You'll break something.
Yeah, break stuff, like go figure some stuff out. So it's like, as a PhD student, that's kind of your job is to figure out something that nobody else has, which is kind of a tall order, but it's what's so fun about it. And
It is.
yeah.
So what else are you doing? Are you teaching
I am.
this semester?
I am. So I am teaching a graduate course in chemical kinetics that has never been taught at
Okay.
Rutgers before, and that I've never
Okay.
personally taken myself.
Wow.
So
Sounds like a PhD all over again.
it's fun. Well, it's so the thing I'm running into here, and I hope I'm doing a good job of not making too many mistakes about this, is all of my kinetics training is based on chemical engineering kinetics, which is we don't mind doing PDEs, we don't mind doing crazy math, and we're doing stuff on like, you have a giant reactor that's pumping out 400 gallons of stuff, and you have these transport properties. And I realize chemists don't want to do that. Like, no, they don't want to do that. And so
No.
I'm like trying very, very hard to make it more applicable to chemistry. And so we're doing right now, we just did actually today in class the derivation of Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution functions
Okay.
as a way to show, this is like if you have a temperature, your temperature you're reporting is not your only temperature. You have a big variation of energies and molecular velocities and so on. And I feel like, no one likes derivation, so. But
Maybe some chemists like it.
maybe some chemists, but I feel like I'm excited. This is like all of the background stuff I had to do to get to the actual
Yeah.
kinetics. Because I feel like if you don't have that background where you kind of understand that, if we say your reaction happens at 50 degrees Celsius, not everything is at 50 degrees Celsius, or
Right.
like,
And you have to recognize that
right. Yeah, I mean
to be able
that's
to
actually one of
go
the
to the
things.
next step.
Right, it's one of the things that's crazy. It's like that big tail end up of a higher probability. Like it causes uncertainty. And I literally told them this today in class. It was like you could be the world's greatest chemist. You could literally be the most careful, meticulous chemist in the universe, but you always will have an error bar because of this distribution. I'm like always, always. I was like
That's
every
why
system.
you always see chemistry PhD presentations, of which I've been a lot to a lot. All of their plots always have an error bar, and the engineering majors don't.
Right, which is crazy. Well,
Know.
okay, my big pet peeve, whenever I'm reading stuff in electrochemical energy storage, someone's like, the capacitance is 257.6 farads per gram. Exactly that.
Exactly.
I'm like, come on. First of all, significant figures. Second of all, like, did you just run one CV on one cell?
Like, I guarantee if you run that one more time, it will not be that number.
Right. I'm like, are you just reporting the highest number? Yes, I guess so. But like,
Yes.
yeah, I mean that
Yeah.
well, that's the thing. It's like uncertainty analysis, error analysis is absolutely paramount to having good science because like if you don't take that into account, you can make your graphs show whatever you want pretty much.
Yes.
By just picking whichever values. I actually gave an example of that at some point. I can't, it was at one of my presentations because my PhD relied super heavily on statistics and I had like 300 data points for like 300 data points in each of the individual error bars. And if you
Oh,
did,
wow.
yeah, if you did not take the average and then you had the error, you could actually make the curve go in either direction if you
Change.
pick the extreme values. And so I was
Yeah.
like, you could literally make this show whatever you want if you're not doing
And
good
here's
stuff.
why statistics and error is important. Yeah. Wow. That's cool. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying teaching, because that's a big part of your job now.
Yeah, I think this
Have you
first
had teaching experience before
I did.
when you were a postdoc?
I
Yeah.
did. So whenever Yuri went on sabbatical, I got to teach his course. So I taught materials characterization, which was, a very, very nice course. It was a very nice overview of I think 9 or 10 different material science techniques. The science, the theory behind it, the operation of the equipment, and then actually analyzing data. It was, to be honest, a course like that is absolutely phenomenal for anyone in material science, like that's doing research. And it was very interesting because at Drexel you have, for the undergraduate students, you have maybe I would say 30 to 40% of the undergraduates that do undergraduate research. And those students I could tell really cared about this class. And the other students really did not care about this class.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's a lot of information if you don't do materials characterization. Like, if you don't care about it, it's a lot to
Right.
kind of grasp.
Yeah, if you're like, I
But
never use XPS, I will never use XPS, then
it's,
yeah,
yeah.
it's like you're gaining useless knowledge.
Yeah. That is a good course, though. All right, let me just check my questions. Okay, so I'm gonna go to my three wrap-up questions, but first I want to know about you. What are your hobbies now as an adult?
Oh, scary.
Job.
So a couple of things, actually. So a couple of things I've been doing. One of the things is I like to read a lot, but I do not read science books when I'm at my house.
That's
So
a good,
what I
I mean, you
do,
can read science books when you're at work, right?
exactly. So what I do
Yeah.
is whenever I like to go to like library sales, and you pick up books that are interesting on whichever topic. And so I have roughly a million books that I'm reading. And some of them I'm like kind of a little scared to start. I picked up like a six volume series on Abraham Lincoln. It's
Okay.
like 3,000 pages. So it was like
So it's like fully nonfiction
it's
on Abraham
fully
Lincoln.
nonfiction. And so it's like 100%
Yeah.
nonfiction. So I'm like excited to start that, but dreading it. I'm also reading, Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. She actually
Yeah.
wrote the first post-apocalyptic novel as well. And so
Really?
I'm reading that as well.
That's cool.
So it's basically like anytime I see a book that's interesting, like I'm at a library sale, I'm like, it's like $1 or $2. Like, why not?
Bring it home, put it on the pile.
Right, bring it home, like eventually I'll read it,
Yeah.
probably. So I do that. I have a love-hate relationship with running. I'm in my hate phase right now, but I did a half marathon about a year ago and a half marathon about a year before that. But now I'm in my kind of,
So you're in your lull.
yeah. Like I get good enough to do a half marathon and then I basically quit. And then I'm like, I
Yeah.
really should get back into running. And then I get good enough to do a half marathon and I do it and
And then you quit. Yeah.
then
Well, at least you're consistent. You know,
I
we can we could plot your running skill on
Yeah, that's on a sine function.
sine wave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean it's mostly stuff like that. I'm trying to just be kind of well-rounded, make sure I don't just sit around and watch TV. So I get out and exercise.
Or work all the time,
Right. Well,
right?
yeah, exactly. It's like that's my big advice for if anyone here is doing their PhD is don't work 24 hours a day. Like, you have to work long hours. You have to be good and do stuff like that. And there's some days you have to like really grind, but like you can't really grind every day. Like there's
Yeah.
no way. And so a lot of my actually best ideas come from whenever I'm reading this random stuff. 'Cause you're like
Yeah.
subconscious wanders or I don't know how your brain works.
Yeah. That's great. That's good advice. Don't work 24 hours a
Don't
day.
work 24
It's
hours a day.
impossible. Nobody can do it.
Right.
Is there anything you miss about your time as a PhD student?
I must say, I had a great PhD. I miss everything about my
Yeah.
PhD. I had so
Yeah.
much fun. I had so much fun as a PhD student. It's
That's great.
because I was, I, look, I mean, honestly, I was doing really cool research. My PI was amazing. I had really good friends at Notre Dame. I met my wife at Notre Dame. I got to do a Fulbright in Russia for 9 months. I did an internship at a national lab.
Conferences.
I went to roughly one conference a year. I had a great time. I
Wow.
miss a ton from my PhD.
Yeah. It's interesting. I hear some people feel that way, and then some people are like, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know? And that's a shame because I you know, one of my goals of this podcast is to make it clear that there are people that did have good experiences and that there are ways that you can control your destiny in that way. And some of that is like picking the right group for you and picking the right research and the right PI and doing the work ahead of time so that you do have a good experience.
Right. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's, who is the perfect PI for me may not be the perfect PI for you. And it depends on, your and my personalities, and you have to find the person that fits for you. And it's also one of the things like, I think a lot of people go into PhDs with, expectations that, I'm going to go in and win a Nobel Prize and be the world's greatest scientist and whatever. And like, to be honest, that's not super realistic. Like I've heard a couple Nobel Prize winners speak, and one of the resounding things is they like stumbled upon what they discovered by accident.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Like they were like, "That's pretty weird. I have no idea why it's doing that, and I'm gonna figure out why." They were not
Yeah.
like, "I have the idea that I can make a quasi crystal if I do this super
Right.
specific chemistry or whatever." And they were like, "I did this, something weird happened, and I figured out why a weird thing happened."
And part of that is their personality being someone that wants to figure out why that happened, whereas other people would be like, well, that didn't work. Let me try something else, you know. But the other thing is that, you know, nobody stumbling on something could happen to anybody, and it's whether or not you kind of pursue it and dig in deeper or walk
Right.
away.
Well, actually, so I don't know. Have you ever heard Shekman, the guy who discovered quasicrystals, give his talk?
No, I haven't.
One day you should listen to it, and anyone listening to this podcast should listen to it, because I'll give you like the super condensed gist.
Okay.
He discovered quasicrystals because it had a weird TEM diffraction pattern, and
Okay.
so he spent a year figuring out what it was. No one agreed, like nobody believed him. They all thought he was a crackpot. It gets published. He eventually gets a Nobel Prize. When he gets the Nobel Prize, someone comes up to him. I mean, not immediately afterwards, I guess, but like at some point, and was like,
Yeah.
"I saw the same thing like 10 years or like 8 years before he did." And they were like, "I saw it. I didn't tell my PI, and I just graduated and left." And they were
Thought the
like,
TEM was broken and I walked
yeah,
away.
they were like, "It. I didn't know what it was. I thought something weird was going on. I was graduating in 3 months and I just did not care." And I was like, that guy could have got a Nobel Prize.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's crazy. I love that. Okay, last question. What do you have a good memory or story from your time as a PhD student that you would like to share?
Yeah, I'll give a very broad stroke. Story.
Okay.
Okay, so one of the greatest conferences, in my opinion, are the Gordon Research Conferences. So the GRC, and then the Associated for PhD Students and Postdocs, the GRS, so the Gordon Research Seminar, I think that's what it is. GRS and GRC. So the GRC, it's like a super hyper focused conference, where you have like maybe 100, 150 people there. And so my PI and I went to it. I think it was probably my last year of my PhD. And it was up in Vermont in a ski town in the middle of summer. And so honestly, like what it was is I was graduating soon. I presented my stuff in the GRS. And basically for that week, because it's a week-long conference. Like every other night, my PI and I would hang out. Like we went hiking one day, and we were just talking about how to get a professorship, what the best things to do were. One day we were in a sauna together, which was really kind of weird, but pretty fun. I mean, I don't know. It was pretty fun. And it's just like, I look back on those times very fondly. Because I realized it was like, my PI really just cared about me. He wanted to make sure I was successful. He wanted to make sure that, I knew what steps to take. And actually, interestingly enough, not this summer, but the previous summer. So we're in 2023. So summer of 2022, I was at a conference in Italy, and I ran into my PhD advisor there. Yeah,
Wow.
I know. So he's a very loud guy, and I heard him in breakfast yell talking. He just yell talking. He's a very loud
Yeah.
guy. I come up to him and I like step behind him, put my hand on his shoulder. He turns around and his eyes go wide, and he's like, and
He's surprised.
he was like, "Let's go check out the city together." And then we were like,
Aww.
"Let's do it." And we literally just left. We like,
Skip the conference.
no, the conference started like the next day or two
Oh,
days or
gotcha.
something. It was
Okay.
like the day before the conference, and we just went and we hung out in Perugia, Italy, and we had the same kind of similar conversations. We go, it's gonna sound weird, we got dinner on a lake together. It was
Well, now
very,
you guys are like colleagues,
yeah.
right?
Well,
Like,
yeah,
you
but
know.
he still, I would never call him his first name.
Yeah.
Never, 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 ever,
Never.
never, ever. It's still like it's kind of funny. Like when I email him, like email Yuri, like hey Yuri,
Yeah.
I email my PI like Dr. Mukasian.
Yeah. Formal.
Yeah, like, well, it's, I mean, it's a different culture. Well, actually, it's not a different culture, though. That's kind of weird now that I think about it.
Then Yuri,
Yeah, they both grew up in USSR. I don't know, whatever.
yeah, whatever.
Different people approaches. But honestly, my fondest memory is honestly all of the stuff with my PI. He was so wonderful. I had such a good time with him. And every single time I run into him, I'm always reminded so much of what a phenomenal PI is like.
Do your paths overlap, like field-wise, enough that you run into him at conferences? What conference was in Italy?
Ceramics conference.
Okay.
So that was the only conference we've ever overlapped in as a postdoc when I was doing my postdoc and research assistant professorship. My lab, I'm gonna focus on some more fundamental stuff as well as like 2D materials and some other stuff. And so hopefully I get to run into him again soon. For sure, when I organize a conference on that, I'm gonna invite him, even if he's retired. So
Yeah.
yeah, like why not? He's never gonna
That'd be
retire
great.
though. No one retires from academia.
No, they can't. They'd
Exactly.
be too bored.
Yeah,
All right, Chris. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer. That was really, really fun. Is there anything you want to plug? I mean, you're a professor now, so are you recruiting students?
I'm always recruiting students. I guess I'll give my pitch. So
Yes,
I'm
please.
doing fundamental reaction kinetics, both in the solid state and non-equilibrium chemistry in the liquid state, as well as two-dimensional materials. All of it does tie together. It all ties together in making precursors and actually producing the 2D materials or producing novel low-dimensional other ceramics. So
Okay.
yeah. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, come find me at Rutgers, the chemistry department. I'm
Cool.
always say I'm always recruiting students, and we'll find out once I get
Yeah.
more grants and stuff, but I am for sure recruiting students this year and next year and the year after.
What is your group? Does your group have a name?
No, we don't have a name yet.
It's the Shuck group.
Yeah, I just started at Rutgers 10 days ago, so it's in terms of coming up with a clever name of my group, I haven't done that yet.
That's fair. That's fair.
Maybe
Your priorities
next
are
year I'll
right.
have a name, yeah.
Okay. Well, though, for those listening, you can find him otherwise outside of a group name, and you can bring your group name ideas.
Yeah, you could if you come with me with a really good group name, you could for sure get into my group.
Yeah.
Thank
All right, Chris, thank you so much. Thanks for coming on the show.
you so much. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks to Chris for coming on the show. If you or someone you know wants to be interviewed on Impact Factor, feel free to reach out via Instagram and follow us for updates at Impact Factor Pod. Thank you all for listening and have a great week.